charitable trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon.
I want a new duck, one that won't try to bite, one that won't chew a hole in my socks, one that won't quack all night. I want a new duck, one with big web feet, one that knows how to wash my car and keep its room real neat. One that won't raid the icebox, one that'll stay in shape, one that's never gonna try to migrate or escape, or I'll tie him up with duct tape.
Yeah, that's Weird Al. I want a new duck. One of Susie Gilbert's great passions in life is rehabilitating injured wild birds. She's helped all kinds of birds, including turkey vultures, red-tailed hawks, blue jays, robins, and ducks. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Susie Gilbert joins us this afternoon to tell us about this passion, a passion she details in her memoir, Fly Away, How a Wild Bird Rehabber Sought Adventure and Found Her Wings. Susie Gilbert is also passionate about her family, husband John Horgan and their children Sky and Mac. Fly Away is also about them and life in their home that had been turned into a bird hospital and rehab facility. This comes from the description of the book. Gilbert chronicles the years with delightful wit, recounting the confusion that ensued as her husband and two young children struggled to live in a house where parrots shrieked Motown songs, nestling robins required food every 20 minutes, and recuperating herons took over the spare bathroom. Susie Gilbert is a longtime bird enthusiast who began volunteering at a raptor rehabilitation center in 1990. She opened her home-based bird rehab center, Fly Away Incorporated, in 2002. She's the author of a book for children, Hawk Hill. Her new book, Fly Away, How a Wild Bird Rehabber Sought Adventure and Found Her Wings, is published by Harper. Visit her at her website, SusieGilbert.com, and Susie is spelled S-U-Z-I-E. There you'll find video of her releasing a female red-tailed hawk. Susie Gilbert, welcome. How are you?
I am fine, thanks. How are you, Celeste?
I'm fine. I couldn't resist playing I Want a New Duck.
I laughed.
Good. Because among the patients readers meet in Fly Away are some ducks, including a wood duck named Daisy. You want to tell her story?
Well, Daisy arrived one day. There were two people who had found her in a park, and they looked everywhere for her parents and her siblings, and they could find nothing. And they were so worried about her because she was absolutely tiny. And they called me up and begged me to take her, and I said, I don't do ducks. And they said, but you have to take her. We have nowhere else to go, which is, you know, what happens to me. So I ended up taking this little duck and doing all kinds of research on how to raise her correctly. At first, I didn't even think she was a wood duck. I thought she was a mallard, which, you know, was sort of a surprise sooner or later. But she was incredibly sweet, and we got her eating. And it took me a little while, but I eventually found her other wood ducks that she could grow up with, because this is the main thing with raising any kind of bird, is you don't want to raise them by themselves. You need buddies for them. You need them to know that they're a specific kind of bird and not a human.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Daisy's duck box?
Ah, duck box. There, every bird that comes in, every species of bird has a different setup that they need in order to feel secure. So a duck box is you take a cardboard box, you have a smaller cardboard box that you put inside it. In the second box, you put a feather duster through a hole in the top of the box so that when the little duck is scared or, you know, wants to go to sleep, they can run into the little box and snuggle up next to the feather duster, which makes them feel like mom is there.
I'm calling my feather duster Daisy now.
Oh, good.
And the other thing, when I go to the grocery store, I think I'm going to Grubco.
To Grubco.
So you've got to tell us about Grubco. Tell us, you know, no 2 days are alike as a bird rehabber. That said, you know, can you give us some sense of what a day in the life is like?
Boy, it is so hard to say because unless you end up specializing and take only a certain species of bird, you never know what's going to come through the door. And every day is a surprise. You get different species. You get different injuries. Some of them are orphaned and they're perfectly fine, but others have really severe injuries and, you know, you become an emergency room. And, you know, what rehabbers do is we stabilize the bird, make sure that, you know, he's not on the verge of death. We get him to where he can be transported to a veterinarian. And most of us have a few vets that we work with. And the veterinarians who donate their time to help injured wild birds are just saints because they don't get paid for it. And they're really wonderful. We couldn't do our work without them. So it's hard to say what a typical day would be like. But as far as Grubco goes, you know, we have to have food on hand
right.
for all different kinds of birds. And there is, you know, you can get anything on the Internet. So I used to have mealworms and waxworms, all kinds of little grubby insects, sent to me through the mail. And I'd have live crickets, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 live crickets sent through the mail to me. And this has its own dangers. There is one story in my book where, unfortunately, the box containing the crickets broke at the post office. And there was a woman there who was really scared of bugs. So it was a little dicey. I had to go do a cricket roundup.
And then you've got, if you've got raptors, you need some bigger food.
Oh, yeah. I've got a freezer that, you know, most people would look inside it and just scream and run. I get mice, I get rats, I get all kinds of rodents donated to me. They're already frozen when they get here, and I keep them in a freezer, and then as needed, I just go out and defrost them. So that's the freezer that I tell my guests not to look at.
When and how did your interest in birds begin?
I've always been interested in all kinds of animals. You know, ironically enough, the only kind of pet I didn't have when I was a child was a bird. But when I was in my 20s, I was given a yellow-collared macaw as a gift, you know, a young one. And he was, I guess he was the beginning of the end. So I fell in love with birds. And for a while I did parrot rescue. There are so many homeless parrots in the world. People think they're beautiful and they're, you know, look nice and they have no clue as to how difficult they are to care for. They are really needy creatures. They're flock animals and they want attention all the time. And when they don't get it, they figure out ways to make you pay attention to them.
Yeah, they're really demanding. Tell us a little bit about Zach and Mario.
Yeah, well, Zach was my first parrot, the little yellow-collared macaw, and he's sort of like James Cagney. He just swaggers around and causes all kinds of trouble. And Mario was an African gray who was a rescue. I got him when he was 5 years old, and I was his fourth home. And, you know, birds really like routine, so it was amazing how good he was when he came to us. But both of them have incredible personalities, and they're really funny birds. I've had them for years and years, and they're certainly part of the family.
Yeah, how is the family?
Fine. My kids are teenagers now. When I started, when I wrote the book, when I opened Flyaway, my kids were 7 and 8 years old, and now they're teenagers. So my son is almost driving.
Well, what have your kids, Sky and Mac, learned as a result of being surrounded with all these birds?
Well, I think, one, they learn tolerance.
Yeah.
I guess in a big way. But, you know, they've really learned about nature, and I guess, you know, it's the circle of life in a way. There's so many things that go on when you're rehabbing any kind of animal, not, you know, birds and mammals, and there are some people who do reptiles, but there's birth. We get the little tiny babies, we raise them until they're adults and then let them go. There's death, because some of these birds are injured so badly that we can't save them. You know, sometimes we've put time and effort and we really think a bird is going to make it, and they don't. You know, it's a shock, and it's sad, mm-hmm. and it's upsetting. But then, on the other hand, there have been birds who come in and we just, you know, almost guarantee he's a goner, and then we go out the next morning and there's the bird, not only standing, but, you know, preening or almost eating. So, I think you have to sort of go with the flow when you do this. But I think all in all, it was really good for the kids. You know, they've never, whenever we sit around and talk about stories of sort of when we had lots and lots of birds here, they tell good stories. They don't say, I can't believe you raised me like that. At least not yet.
You know, the losses are inevitable.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's got to take a toll when you might have a string of some really bad days.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You really do. And rehabbers are in this game because they love these creatures so much. And, you know, speaking for myself, I just think there's nothing more magical than a bird. They're just the most amazing creatures. And, being able to take one that's injured and help it to heal and then watch it fly away is just the most incredible feeling in the world. Mm. But at the same time, you know, putting, you know, your time and your heart and your soul into a bird and then he doesn't make it, you know, that's really tough. So you try for the balance, but you know, sometimes it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Speaking of balance, it can be tough to nurse an animal back to health, and the goal is to see it go off and live where it should be living. But then occasionally it's tough to see that, and maybe you would tell us about a crow named George.
George. George was my spiritual master. I think he came along after I had a really, really tough stretch where I was working so hard. One of the problems with rehabbing at home is that it's there all the time. People show up at your door at any given time. You don't really have time off unless you make it, and it's hard to draw that line. So I had been working really, really hard, and I was just burned out. And I finally closed for a while because I thought I couldn't do it anymore. And then someone brought me this fledgling crow, not even a fledgling, it was a nestling crow, who had fallen from the nest. It had been a storm. Siblings were killed. And they brought them and said, well, you know, I don't have anywhere else to bring this crow. Would you take him? And I did. I have a real soft spot for crows. They are so smart. They're so funny. And I took him in, and I found another crow so he wouldn't grow up alone and raised the two of them. And he just really, he rehabbed me because at that point I really needed it. And he was just the most joyful creature I've ever encountered. He was wonderful. And I let him go. the end of the summer with his crow friend, and they stayed around. They stayed around for the fall and would come on hikes with me, and the kids and I would go through the woods, and I'd have George behind us flying around, and it was really wonderful. But then he decided it was time for him to go, and he did. Mm. You know, you really can't control a wild bird once he's up in the air.
Yeah. Well, you'll never forget him.
Never.
Yeah.
No.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Susie Gilbert. She is a wild bird rehabber, and she's the author of Fly Away, How a Wild Bird Rehabber Sought Adventure and Found Her Wings. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, stories. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. The opening anecdote in the book is about a turkey vulture. That's got to be a tough bird to round up because of how they're put together and what they do for a living.
Yeah. You know, this is another bird I have a real soft spot for. I like turkey vultures. I guess the ones that get the bad rap are the ones that I like the best. But turkey vultures, again, are very smart, sociable, funny birds. They are scavengers, and yes, they clean up everything. But they do a wonderful job. You know, they have their niche in the ecosystem, and they're really great birds. And my beginning story was of a turkey vulture that had a broken wing, and I had to chase him down. And people think of these great big birds soaring through the air and don't really realize how fast they can run when they have to. And I had to chase this bird through about I don't know how many backyards trying to get him. I think by the time we were, I don't know who was more tired by the time I finally got him. But they do have this charming habit of if you grab one and they're scared of you, instead of biting you or grabbing you with their feet, they will throw up on you.
Yeah.
And it's not all that pleasant.
No. If you think of their diet,
yes, exactly.
You got a clear picture.
You got the idea.
Yeah. Let's take a call from a listener waiting for us on the toll-free line in Montgomery. Line 4, hi.
Hey, good morning, or good afternoon. I just ate lunch, guys. Come on.
Good afternoon.
No more vulture stories.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's just like the roadkill scenario, you know. But anyway, I built a pond in my backyard a few years ago, and I made it so I could put some plants around there and try to attract birds, you know. But it's what I'm going to get to here is it's a lovely way to watch things. The birds that come every year, you know, you got the seasonal birds. Some of those yellow finches with the black stripes on them, they come in. Then you've got the cardinals. Uh-huh. And, doves, lots of doves, they come in and they take a bath in the river that I made, the little stream. I made it so they could stand on a rock or two and basically take their bath.
But, oh, how nice.
It's enjoyable. I love it. I mean, the only downfall I have is that every once in a while a hawk will fly by or you know, I'm worried about herons. I'm fortunate to where it's kind of shaded a little bit by a tree, and it's kind of hard to get to unless they're really paying attention. But, you know, hawks have gotten some of the doves from time to time, but they haven't gone in for the fish, and I'll get some koi in there. But I'm throwing everything, the whole gamut into it, and it's enjoyable. So I always tell people if you get a chance, you got to build yourself a little pond and get the right plants to attract people and get the fur. I mean, I've got possums drinking out of it, raccoons drinking out of it. I've actually had deer back there. So.
Wow. Oh, well, I wish more people were like you. This is great. That's the best thing you can do is put out water and those good plants that they like, and And occasionally a hawk will come by, but, you know, that's what they do. They're hungry.
And, it's Mother Nature.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's really hard to be a hawk. There are lots more little birds than there are hawks, and it's because 80% of raptors don't make it through their first year. They end up starving to death. So
I grew up with the out in California with the northern part of the state. They had breeding. Now I've got a mind blank. You can tell I'm over 50.
I'll join the crowd.
Yeah, but you know, they out west they used to do a lot of breeding with these birds.
The condors.
The condors, right? And okay. I mean, people used to go up and shoot them all the time.
Oh God!
Because I used to work for the Forest Service, and when I used to go up in these mountain roads, you'd find one or two dead, you know, every so often. Or the big problem was with the Edison people out there. They would get on the lines and get, you know, shocked. But
yeah.
You know, people don't respect them. The same thing with the geese. I mean, I love the geese. I know they crap all over everything, but you know, that's just birds. You know, and I ask people too. I say, well, you got dogs, you got animals. I mean, what do you let your dog, you know, go out in the backyard and crap? The point is, we're here to, you know, actually, it's their planet. That's the way I look at it, not ours, theirs. So anyway, that's my 20 cents, I guess. Celeste has enough, so I'm out of here. See you guys.
Okay, take care.
It was nice to hear from you. That's so great, you know, when people really, really make an effort to put habitat out there, because this is such a problem for birds all over the country, is the loss of habitat. We take away what they need to live. So when people give it back, it's wonderful, and you know, you're so rewarded if you put out something like that, because you see all these different creatures that come and are happy to accept your hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Other telephone calls are invited this afternoon. Join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Susie Gilbert, author of Fly Away, How a Wild Bird Rehabber Sought Adventure and Found Her Wings. My name is Celeste Quinn. Well, would you tell us about that red-tailed hawk that we see in the video on your website?
Ah, yes. She came in. The people, a man called me and said he had a red tail down in his backyard. And as it turned out, it was a great big female. She had broken her metacarpals, which would be sort of like, you know, like our hand. And two bones were broken. And she couldn't fly. So I took her to a vet that I work with, and she turned out to be this incredibly ferocious bird. she just wanted to kill anyone who came near her. I am very careful of hawks' feet, and I went to catch her, and I held her with my gloves, and she managed to get her head out from under the towel that I had over her and bit me in the hand. Then I took her to the vet, and she got the vet technician, and she almost got my son. She was really something.
Whoa.
And, you know, birds like that, I am so in awe of birds like that. I think they're just amazing, and I have so much respect for them. So it took her a while to heal. We couldn't wrap her because she just, every time we'd put a bandage on that wing, she'd rip it right off. So I had to set up a whole, you know, a different kind of an enclosure for her, so that I didn't have to ever pick her up when I went to clean, so she could just keep the wing set herself.
Mm.
And she healed, and we took her back to where she had been injured. And I think the beginning of that video shows me pulling her out of the crate.
Yeah.
And what the video doesn't show is me struggling with her for 5 minutes, trying to get her out of the crate while she did her best to take my arm off.
What a strong character.
Yes.
She's so big and beautiful and fierce all at the same time.
Yeah.
What is a red-tailed hawk weigh?
Well, you know, it looks like, you know, take a guess. What would you think they'd weigh? They look so big.
Yeah, but, you know, that's a lot of feathers.
It is. And the thing is, bird bones are hollow. just so that they are more flight-worthy. So actually, a big bird like that only weighs about 2 pounds.
Really?
Yeah.
I would have guessed 5.
Yeah. Nope. That's it. They lots of feathers, and they don't weigh all that much. Of course, if you have one that's an education bird, and you're standing there with the bird on your glove for long enough, they feel like they weigh more.
Yeah.
But
well, that's a great big, beautiful bird, weighing in at 2 pounds. So, what does a house finch weigh?
Oh, let's see. House finch would weigh about maybe, 12, 13 grams.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Those little tiny sparrows you see out, chipping sparrows, weigh 10 grams. They are just, they're so little and so delicate looking, but, you know, sometimes deceptively so. I mean, they migrate all the way down to South America. So it's amazing what sort of resilience can be put into this tiny little delicate package.
Yeah. The first bird that you cared for at your home was a house finch. What had happened to him?
I think he may have hit a window. Somebody found him and brought him. He had a dislocated wing and healed well enough so that he could fly a little bit. He could fly sort of from branch to branch in my flight cage, but never healed well enough to be released to, get away from predators or to be able to withstand a long winter, unfortunately. But I had him for a whole summer, and he became sort of a den mother. He raised a bunch of small fledglings, nestlings, and he really was a wonderful bird. I ended up finding him a sanctuary down in North Carolina, who they had a big, beautiful songbird enclosure that was permanent, and it had heat, it had lights and lots of trees, and so he ended up going down there so he could live his life out.
I thought it was really interesting. There's a scene in the book where you have him at the vet, and the vet, Alan, is telling you how to manipulate his wing, a little physical therapy.
Yes.
And the following day, you're there working with him, and you say, he just looks resigned to it. This is not like the red-tailed hawk. This little guy is a different story altogether. And you say that he looked resigned, you say, despite the fact that birds' faces are fixed and supposedly cannot show expression. Over the years, has your understanding of the expression, do birds have expressions? What can you tell us about that?
You know, they do. And they have expressions, they have body language, and the more time you spend around any kind of creature, the more attuned you are to how they feel, what's going through their head at the time. I have found that I can sort of feel their stress level, even though they're trying to hide it, because birds put on a brave front. They don't want to look as if they're sick or injured, because then they're a good target for a predator. But I absolutely think that you can pick up their body language, that each of these birds has a distinct personality. And that ferocious red tail, the next red tail I got in was the mellowest, easiest going bird. He was just so easy to deal with. And this little house finch was, a sweetheart of a bird. But there can be house finches that are kind of a pain in the neck.
Let's take a couple of additional telephone calls here. Next, we're going to go to Muhammad, a listener on line one. Hi.
Hi. I turned in late, so I might ask a couple questions that you don't know. But I have two questions.
Sure.
One is, what birds eat Japanese beetles and mosquitoes. And my other question is, in our woods we had about 4 years ago, great horned owls had a baby. Mm-hmm. And they hung around for a year, and I wanted to know about their behavior. Would they be returning, or will we not necessarily ever see them again?
Well, let's see. Japanese beetles and mosquitoes, you know, I'm not – most birds eat a whole variety of bugs. Most of the songbirds you see eat mosquitoes, I would say almost all of them. Mosquitoes are a really – good ticket on the menu for songbirds. That's why it's so good to have songbirds around. Bats too. They eat mosquitoes. You know, put up bat houses, and they do an incredible job keeping the mosquito population down. As far as Japanese beetles, I'm not sure which ones, but I'm sure if you go online, Google Japanese beetles and then birds, and see what comes up. As far as the great horned owls, you are so lucky to have them in your woods. They're very cool birds, and you should be seeing them. They are very territorial.
So they would be coming back repeated from year to year?
Yeah, and they may not go anywhere at all. I mean, they don't migrate. So they will probably be around you. They may go a little deeper into the woods or. Their territory is fairly large, so they may not be in exactly the same spot every night, but they should be around you.
I think the year that we saw them, it might have been we were just lucky that when they were building their nest, you know, the leaves weren't on the trees yet, and they were just building their nest within sight of where we usually sit in the evenings, so we could see them at dusk working on the nest. And when the chick was born, we were just amazed at how huge it was and could still just be white fuzz.
Yes, they're amazing looking little,
yeah.
Well, big things.
I have to say that our rabbit population has been quite reduced ever since then.
Ah,
they are
yes.
Still around. We just see them.
They are amazing hunters.
Yeah.
Yeah, and great horned owls have a grip that is amazing.
Yeah, you could tell by the size of the baby's claws.
Yes, exactly.
Okay,
if one gets a hold of you, you're in trouble.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Kankakee, line 4. Hi.
Hi there. I have two items. Several years ago, a flock of crows knocked down a great horned owl in the backyard and had it on the ground and. We went out and chased the crows away and put a net over the owl and put her in a dog kennel and she couldn't fly. They had completely worn it out. And my children were going to the University of Illinois then, and they took it back down to a raptor physician or a raptor's saving place, and they eventually turned it loose down there, and it was a neat thing to see, but the crows really got after it, you know.
Oh yeah, I'm so glad that it worked out well, and he could be released.
And the other thing, I just got back from Canada, and my son and I stayed at an outpost camp and quite a ways away from everything, and we had stayed there for years and years, or have stayed there for years and years, and there's always a lot of eagles around there. There's a pair of eagles that had three little ones, which is pretty. I've never seen them with three. Normally they only have two.
Right.
But they had three, and they were fledging, and they're trying to fly and falling off the rocks and getting in the water and trying to swim back and knocking one in. But when we would fillet fish, we'd feed them, and so I hope that we augmented the meals of the little ones, so the parents didn't have to race around trying to catch fish all day. But normally it was really interesting because the if there would be two of them on a big rock in front of the cabin, they'd try and knock each other off of the rock and everything. It was fun to watch them.
Sibling rivalry.
Yes, I'm sure.
They
were driving their parents crazy.
It works across all species.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Anyway, great program. Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this
Thank
afternoon.
You.
Let's take another call from a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello. I'm a teacher, and in my search for inspirational stories, I'm a coach as well. I ran across one about the bald eagle, where the as they go on in age, how they go through kind of a molting period where they grow or get large calcifications on their beaks and can't fly and get really depressed, and some of them even jump off cliffs to commit suicide. They get so down on themselves. But I've also read where the eagles that have gone through this process kind of call out to those who are struggling and drop food down for them because they can't hunt on their own. And I was wondering if you had seen any of that camaraderie or teamwork in your pursuits as a rehabilitator. And I'll just go ahead and hang up and listen to your response. Thanks.
Okay. As far as, yes, eagles definitely go through molts, and I'm not sure about this where they don't feel good about themselves, or I'm not sure where that came from. I think eagles are usually pretty satisfied with themselves. They probably more often than not, they will skirmish over food. If one has a fish, they'll try and keep it away from each other. Unless if there are two eagles that are mates, one will share food with the other, and they'll of course feed their babies. There are relationships where they do help each other through hard times. I mean, there are many examples of birds, one bird being injured and on the ground, and others coming to feed him. I had was a great horned owl in at one point, and people saw this owl on the ground for quite a while. Nobody called me for a while, but they did see this owl on the ground, and they would watch the mate coming with food to feed this injured owl. So, they do tend to take care of each other.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, on line one. Hi.
Yeah, they do.
I'm sorry. We'll see if that person can call back. I don't know if there's a problem there with the line.
Okay.
Anyway, let's talk about when one comes across a bird that you think has been injured. What do you look for? Because you don't want to take an animal out of its setting unless it's absolutely necessary, right?
Right, exactly.
So if we come across an injured bird or something, or a bird we suspect has been injured, what do we do?
Well, if it's in the spring and you can see that it's a young bird and it's hopping around, usually those are the birds that are okay. Fledglings, especially songbird fledglings, they leave their nest. They go out on the branches, they lose their balance, they fall down, then they hop around, they go mm-hmm. back up. The problem is when they run into, an outdoor cat or people who want to help but don't realize that the parents are still feeding them. So if you come across a young bird like that, the best thing to do, just make sure there aren't pets around. Keep the dogs in, keep the cats in. Cats should all be inside anyway. But the parents are normally around, and they help to feed him, and they'll keep an eye on him. If it is a bird that's obviously got an injury, his wing is broken, he can't fly. If he's, you can see he's hit a window, he's on his side. If it's outside your house, if it looks like he's been, knocked into a window, you can get a box, a cardboard box, and get a towel or some paper towels, put it in the bottom. Put him in there, keep him dark and quiet and away from any kind of commotion for, half an hour, and then see if he's okay. I would, when you go to check and see if he's okay, I would take him outside. So if he open it up, and you don't want him flying around your house and then knocking into the window from the other side.
With the cats around.
Yeah. Yes. So, but if it's an injury that, he really needs help, what you can do, get online, Google Illinois Wildlife Rehabilitators or Wildlife Rehabilitation, and you will find rehabilitators. You can also call your local vet, see if they know anybody. You know, you may have to do some legwork because there's a lot of injured wildlife and there aren't as many rehabbers as as are needed.
Yeah.
But if you can get the bird or the animal, whatever is injured, to a rehabilitator, that's, you know, that's the best thing.
Yeah, okay. Let's try our caller in Champaign again. Line one, hi.
Hi there. Sorry about the confusion earlier. I wondered if you knew the story about Marty Stauffer's kestrel pair. He repaired the wing, but it couldn't fly. And 2 years later, the wife kestrel, the female kestrel, was still feeding the male kestrel on the ground under the brushes and so forth like that. Have you heard that story?
Oh, no, no. And it was 2 years he did this.
Oh, the caller's gone again.
Oh, bad connection.
Yeah. What an interesting story, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they, you know, when they pair up, they're usually very loyal, faithful to each other.
Yeah. I wanted to mention the University of Illinois. A caller mentioned the University of Illinois. I think it was the gentleman in Kankakee. The University of Illinois has a wildlife clinic.
Ah,
here in Champaign-Urbana, and it's a wonderful resource. And if people are interested in rehabilitation of wildlife, that's a pretty neat place to check out. They do have spots for volunteers, although they go through a pretty rigorous vetting process, which I think is good.
Yes, that is good because, you know, there are people who have the desire to do it, but somehow just don't connect with the wildlife as well as others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to say who's going to have it and also who's going to be willing to put in the time, because when you have a big center like that, you know, the volunteers really have to be faithful, loyal volunteers, because if you know, the day comes along and they don't show up, then people are really scrambling to fill their place. So they, you know, it's a wonderful thing to be able to volunteer at a place like that, and I absolutely recommend that people check it out and you know, see if they can spend some time. I mean, the payback is just amazing. You'll see things that you've never seen before and wouldn't imagine could happen. But you do need to put the time in.
Yeah. I don't think I could do the work, but you know what? I think I could do a lot more habitat work.
Yeah.
So there's something for everyone to do.
Absolutely.
Let's
you
take.
Know, it's all according to, you know, what you feel you're most comfortable doing, what your passion is. Mm-hmm. I mean, people who save habitat. Oh, I mean, it's just invaluable, because without habitat, there's no wildlife.
Yeah. Let's take a one last call this afternoon. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about robins. Twice now I have seen two robins go after a very young rabbit and chase the rabbit out of its feeding spot in my yard. Is this typical?
Oh, really? you know, I've never seen something like that. But robins are territorial. You know, they have their area that they want for themselves. This could be an area that has lots of good worms.
And, oh, it does.
Okay. And I guess they're saying these are our worms. You know, I probably don't realize the rabbit isn't really into worms. But they are. Even the smallest bird can be very territorial.
Okay.
And you know, even if it's a songbird that doesn't have a hook beak or big talons, they can still be, you know, they can still be kind of formidable in their own way.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, we have to wrap up here now, Susie. Before we go, though, I would like you to say a word or two about the illustrator for Fly Away, Laura Westlake.
Oh, Laura is so talented. She is such a wonderful person, too. She is a bird rehabilitator. She's a fellow rehabber. She lives in New York at the end of Long Island. And I had known her for about 10 years, and we'd never met face-to-face, but we traded birds back and forth. She does a lot of crows, so we have a mutual crow passion. And when I wrote my book, I said to HarperCollins, I wonder if we could have some illustrations, because a lot of people won't be able to visualize the birds I'm talking about. If you're not a birder, you might not know what a cat bird looks like. And they said, well, I don't know. Do you know anyone who might be able to do this? And I said, oh, I have the perfect person, because Laura is an incredible artist. And she sent Harper two samples of her work, and they immediately said, we'd like 20 drawings. Mm. So I sent her photographs of some of the birds that I had rehabbed. So the birds that you see illustrated in the book are actually the birds that I'm talking about.
Mm. Yeah. It's been such a pleasure talking with you this afternoon. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you so much. It's been so nice.
Susie Gilbert has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's a bird rehabber, and she has written a book about this passion of hers for birds and wildlife. The title, Fly Away, How a Wild Bird Rehabber Sought Adventure and Found Her Wings. The book is published by HarperCollins, and I'd encourage you to visit her at her website, susiegilbert.com. There you'll find video of her releasing a female red-tailed hawk, as well as some photographs of some other animals, other birds that have come through her rehabbing center in New York State. SusieGilbert.com. And Susie is spelled S-U-Z-I-E, Gilbert, SusieGilbert.com. That interview was recorded on August 27th of this year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. It's 1:53. Settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Well, wheat and corn were under pressure all session, both ending the day with double-digit losses among most of the contracts, even as soybeans managed to scratch out little gains on the day. We'll have to talk about the particulars during the closing market report with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities. Until then, though, here is how the market settled. Kansas City, December wheat, a high on the day of 556.5, a low of 528, settling 529.5, down 24.5 on the day. March, high of 572.75, a low of 544, settling 545.75, down 24.5. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, a high of 559.75, a low of 531.5, settling 533, down 24.25. March, a high of 581, a low of 552, settling 553.5, down 25. May, a high of 591, a low of 561.75, settling 566.25, down 24.75. July wheat, a high of $6.50, a low of 574.75, settling 576.25, down 24.25. December of 2010, a high of 636.5, a low of 609.75, settling 611, down 23.75. December corn, a high of 387.25, a low of 374.5, settling 376, down 11.25. March, a high of 403.25, a low of 390.25, settling 392, down 11.25. May corn, a high of 413, a low of $4.75, settling 402, down 11.25. July, a high of 421, a low of 409, settling 410.5, down 10.75. September, a high of 427.25, a low of 417, settling 418.25, down 9.25. And go out to December of 2010, a high of 434.75, a low of 424.5, settling 426, down 8.5 on the day. December oats, a high of 258.75, a low of 254.5, settling 257.5, up a quarter. The March contract also up a quarter on the day. The high there, 272. The low, 268.25. And the settlement, 271. January beans, a high of 10.49.25, a low of 10.32, settling 10.46, up 4. March, a high of 10.55, a low of 10.37.75, settling 10.52, up 4.25. May, a high of 10.56, a low of 10.40, settling 10.54.25, up 5. July beans, a high of 10.60.5, a low of 10.43.25, settling 10.58.5, up 6. November, a high of 10.36, a low of 10.17, settling 10.36, up 10. Let's go out to March of 2011, a high of 10.39.5, a low of 10.39.5, but the settlement at 10.43.75, up 10.25 on the day. December soybean meal, a high of 317.30, a low of 311.20, settling 315.40, down 20 cents. January, a high of 311.60, a low of 304.50, settling 309.60, up 50. December soybean oil, a high of 39.95, a low of 39, even the settlement 39.70, up 30. January soybean oil, the high 40.39, the low 39.44, settlement there 40.11, up 29 on the day. We'll have settlements in just a moment. For CME Livestock, this is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Feeder cattle and lean hogs were higher on the day today, while live cattle finished lower. December live cattle, 83.75, the high, the low, 83.20, the settlement, 83.40, down 65. February, 85.82.5, the high, 85.30, the low, 85.50, the settlement, that down 32.5. April, 88.27.5, the high, 87.90, the low, 88.12.5, the settlement, down 25. June, 85.20, the high, 84.80, the low, 84.95, the settlement, that down 15. January feeder cattle, 93.40, the high, 92.70, the low, 93.22.5, the settlement, that down 35. Excuse me, that was up 35. January feeder cattle up 35 on the day today. March, 94.35, the high, 93.65, the low, 94.30, the settlement, up 40. April, 95.65, the high, 94.90, the low, 95.55, the settlement, up 32.5. May, 96.35, the high, 95.85, the low, the settlement, 96.27.5, up 10. December lean hogs, 58.97.5, the high, 58.10, the low, the settlement, 58.62.5, up 32.5. February, 66.40, the high, 65.40, the low, 66 even, the settlement, up 47.5. April, 69.85, the high, 68.95, the low, the settlement, 69.45, up 22.5. And May lean hog, 73.40, the high, 72.75, the low, the settlement, 73.25, that finishing up 12.5. And February pork bellies, 86.72.5, the high, 84.80, the low, the settlement, 86.67.5, up 87.5. The Dow currently off 5 points at 10,446. The NASDAQ is down 5 at 2171. The S&P 500 is up 1 at 1107. Nearby crude down 141 at 76.15 a barrel. It's coming up on 2 o'clock. This is Illinois Public Radio, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2.